For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics with ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel and Republican political consultant Neva Hill. Well, first off, the U.S. Supreme Court saved the Affordable Care Act by upholding subsidies in a 6-3 ruling. The Tulsa World estimates this impacts more than 87,000 Oklahomans who receive subsidies through Obamacare. But Republicans aren't happy about this. Ryan, your thoughts on this ruling?
Yeah, I think Republicans aren't happy about this out front. Behind the scenes, I bet a lot of Republicans are pretty happy, because if this had been struck down, I mean, 80,000 plus Oklahomans, but millions of Americans, this threatened the entire Affordable Care Act itself. If this lawsuit had been successful, it would have undermined the entire Affordable Care Act. It would have made it unworkable as a plan. So where was the backstop? And there wasn't one. And Republicans around the country, especially in states that had created state-run exchanges, were going to have to go to their constituents and explain why all of a sudden they don't have health care anymore. And so they may be out front saying that they're upset about this, but behind the scenes, I bet that they're pretty grateful that the Supreme Court did what they did.
Well,
what the Supreme Court did was par for course. They followed the longstanding tradition that if there's any ambiguity, that you try to read it in the context of a bill. And you know, so you've got thousands and thousands of pages here, and you're looking at about four words, you know, read in context. What the people litigating this wanted the court to do was to say that Congress intended to put this Trojan horse in the bill, mm-hmm. That would completely destroy it at some point. And Justice Roberts just said that's implausible. And so read in context, these subsidies are allowed even in state-based exchanges, and the Affordable Care Act stands.
Neva.
Well, interesting. I mean, it was a 6-3 ruling, but when you read Justice Scalia's interpretation of this and his opinion on the decision, he said that it was quite absurd, and he went on to say that he felt like that it was inarguable that the law actually was written that it intended tax subsidies to be limited to that small number of states that had established those exchanges at the beginning. So, I mean, there's a clear separation here on the court itself in terms of interpretation. I think even as we see others weigh in, Attorney General Scott Pruitt immediately weighed in on this, and he said, you know, and I agree that the ruling on the context of the statute rather than the plain language of the law is unfortunate. I mean, it's not a good day for Americans and for Oklahomans with this Supreme Court ruling. And quite frankly, it is just it's another instance where the court has gone a long way to try to reaffirm this rewriting of ACA by the Obama administration. And clearly, there was a lot at stake for the White House in this to hold their breath and see what happens. So, I mean, yes, they're the winners today, but I don't think that the American people are.
Well, what about all the people that have insurance who would have lost health insurance and would no longer be able to go to doctors, they'd have to go to emergency rooms. That's a
all of those things could have been reworked in the equation. I think this is one of those things where you try to simplify and say four words, and that's all that we were talking about. It's the larger context of the whole concept of how we're going to deal with health care in this country, and I think that's where there is still a strong divide. It is not there is not a consensus anymore in the country than there was on the Supreme Court.
And what's next? So as far as the Affordable Care Act, are there other challenges that still the Supreme Court could be taking up?
You know, I think this is it. I think that the Affordable Care Act moves forward. The idea that we need to debate how the Affordable Care Act works, I agree with that. You know, but are we going to get 60 votes in the Senate? Are we going to get Congress to go along with that? It'll probably come up in front of a new president. I think the likelihood of a lot of that happening, given the gridlock that we see in Washington, is pretty low. And the winners here, you know, I think that the administration, you know, sure, they get to say that they're winners, but the winners are the millions of Americans that get to walk away from this ruling keeping their insurance intact. And the very definition of ambiguity here plays out. And you know, the plain meaning rule, courts, when they're looking at statutes, they look at the plain meaning unless there's ambiguity. And so if you've got Justice Scalia and Justice Roberts, both from the conservative branch of the court, disagreeing over what these words mean, that's the very definition of ambiguity. And so when you reach that ambiguity, the next step in statutory interpretation is to look at the context. And that's what the court did and Justice Roberts and the majority did. And we end up with Affordable Care, the law of the land today.
The political director of the state Republican Party, T.C. Ryan, resigns after more GOP officials, including the governor, calls for him to leave. In an Oklahoma story, it was unveiled, Ryan tried to resign earlier this year, but the leader of the party, former Senator Randy Brogdon, rejected his resignation. Neva, should this have happened sooner?
Well, I think timing being what it was in this instance, I think what we had was a setup for tomorrow when there will be still a Republican State Committee meeting in Tulsa, and the resolution, which everyone was clear was going to be brought forward, was going to be a vote on whether or not they wanted T.C. Ryan to remain in any capacity, official, paid or unpaid, with the Oklahoma Republican Party. And I think the whole backdrop of this is making a clear-cut statement about domestic violence, the fact that there was a significant majority of Republican leaders, activists and elected, who, you know, who were stepping forward saying, we need to be clear on this point. And frankly, we have someone who cannot be the face of the Republican Party who has this issue in their background. So, you know, I think the fact that many were not willing to let it kind of die off or hope that it would go away, it was clear that there was going to have to be some firm resolution. And I think, quite frankly, while this issue has been resolved, there are still some other issues for the Republican Party, because clearly Chairman Brogdon, while he was intractable on trying to keep T.C. Ryan in that position, he also appears to be kind of in a sparring match with his vice chair, Estella Hernandez, who, quite frankly, when she was elected with 87% of the Republican ballots on the first ballot, and Brogdon only had 53% on the second ballot. So, I mean, she's a very popular Republican figure, and I think until they can decide whether they can get along and resolve some of those internal issues, there may still be some things that that Republicans at the state committee level may have to deal with.
Ryan.
Yeah, I was glad to see this the issue of domestic violence come to the forefront. It's unfortunate that this is the way that it had to happen, but it's an important conversation, and it's an important conversation that transcends parties. And I hope that, you know, coming out of this, that legislators, as they've been thinking about this, will move forward into the next legislative session, realizing that the large number of victims in the state of Oklahoma that deal with this every day, it doesn't go away whenever a political story ends. And you know, I liked the governor and a few other folks have said, you know, the Republican Party is the party that believes in redemption and forgiveness, but there's you know, some exceptions to that. And at some point we have to decide, after you've paid your debt to society, do you get to go back to living your life? And I think, you know, most of us, regardless of party, say yes, as long as you meet the job qualifications. And one of the job qualifications in politics is don't be a distraction. And if you're a distraction, you can't do your job. And that's where Ryan found himself in this, is that he was a distraction, that if he'd stayed in that position any longer, it was very difficult for the Republican Party to talk about the things that it wants to be talking about. Even issues like domestic violence, it was difficult for them to have a legitimate conversation about domestic violence with any sort of credibility when you've got this distraction over there. So
I think that's right. Yeah. And I think the other thing is that Chairman Brogdon, one of the points he did make was that when Governor Fallon, who is the leader of the party, stepped forward and made her position known, I think that, frankly, I think it was commendable on his part that he did, in fact, accept the resignation from T.C. Ryan and not try to drag this or prolong this discussion any further. So I think it's commendable that the governor weighed in to make her voice heard, and that at least at this point, hopefully, we can put this one to bed.
Yeah, and I'll turn our attention to the remaining issue of domestic violence in Oklahoma.
Well,
yeah.
Especially in a state with domestic violence is one very high. I think one in
third.
Six,
you know, I mean, we're third in the number of, I think, deaths, you know, murders.
So. And then you think of all the unreported cases exist out there as well. Yeah, big deal.
Oklahoma City Attorney Jerry Fent is challenging the upcoming state budget. The crux of the argument revolves around Oklahoma taking money from the unclaimed property fund to shore up the shortfall. Ryan, does Fent have a case here?
Yeah, it's that time of year. The rains end. It gets hot outside, and Jerry Fent files a lawsuit against the budget.
He sees his shadow.
There's six more weeks of budget litigation. That's the. I think that, you know, Jerry Fent is an incredibly smart lawyer. Anytime he files a case, He's not just filing something that, you know, one of my mentors, Opio Ture, the state representative for many, many years from Oklahoma City, would say is willy-nilly. You know, he doesn't just file these willy-nilly lawsuits. You know, this is a legitimate lawsuit. It's a claim about money that's held in trust for the people of Oklahoma, for their benefit. And if the state of Oklahoma is taking that without any sort of authority and leaving that fund, the unclaimed property fund, underfunded to meet its obligations at some point, and pretty dramatically underfunded, not just a little bit underfunded, but if everybody on that unclaimed property fund all of a sudden shows up and says, we want our funds that we're entitled to, there's no way to pay it out. We can't meet all of those obligations by a stretch. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what the court does with this. I think that courts are reluctant to completely gut a budget deal through judicial fiat. But at the end of the day, the budget has to comply with the law. And if it doesn't, then I think that the courts are going to side with Mr. Finn on this one.
Neva, your thoughts on this law?
Well, I think, as Ryan said, I mean, this is once again what we expect at the end of the legislative session. Everyone, no surprise that the lawsuit was moved forward. You know, I think what we have is two things. We have this question about, is it the constitutionality, the legality of the process, but we also have the politics of it. I mean, let's look at who the defendant is. I mean, former state representative Mike Reynolds, who was the guy that was out there his entire 12 years that he was in the legislature, being kind of the thorn in everyone's side, constantly ratcheting up the discussion and the debate on what was going wrong and what was being done wrong, above the fray and below. So I think it further heightens this kind of divide among Republicans in the legislature about trying to move things forward and trying to deal with what is going to be, unfortunately, at this point, a perennial budget hole that they're going to look at year in and year out for a while. And I think it's unfortunate that if some of these folks, particularly these former lawmakers, can't come to the table with some good ideas and possible solutions rather than just continuing to try to stoke a fire. So, again, I think the court has to make a decision. I agree with you. I don't think that they're going to do anything. It would be surprising that they're going to just kind of open up a total Pandora's box and pandemonium on the budget question after all of this is at this place. But they may again say, okay, legislature, this is the law, and we would like you to follow it a little more closely and directly next time. But the slap on the hand, I think, is probably the worst they get.
What happens if they put a hold on it?
Well, I mean, it depends on how the court does it, right? I mean, they could go all in and put the entire budget back on the table. Or they could just look at the money that was taken from the unclaimed property fund trust and say that was an inappropriate appropriation, and the legislature would have to fill that hole somewhere else, or not.
Special session, and then everything's back on the table.
Yeah.
And then I think you are in an environment where some really deep and serious cuts may be on the table and may have enough votes behind it to become a reality. So it's not a good scenario that sets up on this if we have to go down that road.
But there's no chance that we're going to shut down the government July 1st. Come Tuesday, we don't have a government.
I don't think that that's going to happen. And I think that the if we do, I think this is our season finale.
That's
right now. We'll come back for that, okay? If they shut down the government, we'll come back. I don't think that's going to happen. I think that the court, any sort of actions that they take or ultimate remedies that they have are going to try to mitigate the chaos. They don't want to unleash that on the legislature. And, the special session, that would be kind of interesting because, you know, we've got new revenue numbers that have come in since the legislative mm-hmm. budget. Mm-hmm. The legislature agreed on this budget. So it would be worth coming back for a radio show.
We'd have something to
tune
talk
in.
About.
Yeah.
A group wanting to get rid of Tulsa's sheriff produces a petition calling for a grand jury investigation of his office with more than enough signatures. Mm-hmm. Sheriff Stanley Glanz is now contesting the petition. Neva, what are your thoughts on this news?
Well, it's an interesting question because the sheriff's office basically is saying that they want this motion to dismiss the petition because they didn't do it in a proper way, that the form was not approved, it was misleading, it wasn't didn't adhere to the strict setup of what it was supposed to be legally. You know, I think the bigger question is you have by the election board's determination, you have a sufficient number of signatures. And so if the sheriff is saying, okay, we're okay with a grand jury, but they didn't quite do it, you know, by the letter of the law, so we don't want to have this grand jury, but we have nothing to hide, so, you know, if you do it right, we're more than happy to cooperate. I mean, there seems to be multiple messages going on here, and I think it's unfortunate. If everything is in place, if there's a legitimate grand jury that should be impaneled, then move on with it and get some resolution on this, rather than just continue to drag it out and mire it with all of these, you know, all of these innuendos and assumptions that somehow it's not quite completely proper.
Mm-hmm. Since we're recording this on Thursday, we do know that I think later today the judge is actually supposed to go ahead and panel the grand jury. We don't know if that's happened yet or not. But Ryan, what are your thoughts on the challenge to this petition? Is this something you do because you're being challenged, or right. Do you think there's actually a cause here?
Well, you know, I think legally, petitions, whether it's for a ballot measure or for a grand jury, as in this case, there are a lot of requirements there, and for the most part, those requirements there are there to protect the voters from being duped into signing a petition right. that they otherwise wouldn't have signed if they knew what was really in front of them. And so, you know, a lot of those laws are very good. They're very technical. And I think it's easy to not dot an I or cross a T and end up in a situation like this. And if you're a proponent of an initiative and you're putting together your budget, one of the things that you budget for is a challenge, because you know that there's going to be a challenge out there. That's all on the legal end. It'll be interesting to see how this works out. And whether or not the petitions were sufficient, you know, reading comments from some of the lawyers for the petitioners, they seem to have complied with everything that they thought they needed to. The judge seems to, the election board, everybody seems to be on board, except for the sheriff's attorneys. But we'll see.
Politically, they're supposed to be.
I mean, yeah, I mean, they're supposed to be. The politics of it, I agree with Neva. Even if you've got a legal challenge here, The politics of it are such that you're just delaying the inevitable. You've got over 6,000 people in Tulsa County that signed this. They were verified. I think over 8,000 folks actually signed
6,600
it.
6,600 people or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's big numbers. And to get that in under 45 days is pretty remarkable. I mean, so you can sense very easily that if a court tosses this, these folks with We the People are going to go back out into the streets of Tulsa County, and they're going to get their signatures again, and they're going
to
come back.
They're going to get even more.
They're probably going to get them, get more, and get them faster. Mm-hmm. And you know, so you know, Sheriff Glanz, I really think is delaying the inevitable here. Even if he does have a legal argument, he just need if I were advising him, I would have said, hey, listen, come out and say that you think that there's a legal argument here, but you're ready to resolve this. And that's what the people of Tulsa County want. That's what the people of Oklahoma need and deserve, is some resolution and accountability here. And that's what this grand jury will ultimately do, whether it's this time or if they've got to go back and get the signatures again.
The state Democratic Party is considering the option of opening its primaries to independent voters. The decision would come at a meeting next month. Ryan, is this a good idea for the minority party?
I think it's a great idea. I think it's a great idea for both parties. You know, we're witnessing a couple of different trends. One, the independent voter bloc in Oklahoma, as elsewhere, is growing faster than either of the two parties. I think that we're up to 13% registered independents in the state of Oklahoma. That's a large number of Oklahomans that, just because they don't want to demonstrate a particular allegiance to one party or another, are completely locked out of the primary process. The other thing that's happening is more and more legislative seats in particular are being filled in primary-only campaigns. So not only are you locking independents out, you're locking virtually the other party out as well, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat. Mostly right now, we're in a Republican-dominated state, so it's Republican primaries that are electing folks. So we end up with elected officials, and in particular in the legislature, that are representing very small segments of the population in Oklahoma and registered voters in Oklahoma, because they're the only folks that get to vote. I think open primaries are a really good way to combat that, and allowing folks to go. You hear, and I've been for this for quite a while, and some of the biggest resistance that I've had to this idea has come from Democrats, who traditionally benefited from closed primaries, just the way that Republicans are right now. But there's this idea that folks are going to change the registration to try to game the primary system. I don't think that's going to happen. I think all it does is it opens the door for increased participation, and we end up with people being elected representing more voices.
Neva State Republican Chairman Randy Brogdon opposes the move and says this would be a mistake for the Democratic Party. Do you agree that maybe the Republicans should be looking at this as well?
Well, I think the Republicans have made it clear in the state party platform that they do oppose the idea of of this type of open primary, allowing the independents to vote. And frankly, I don't see any sentiment changing that anytime soon within the Republican ranks, and certainly within the framework of the party platform and the party's official position within their committee structure. So I think the question is what happens among the Democrats. It's clear. I mean, when you have former governors weighing in and many high profile, the former Attorney General Drew Edmondson, I think both the former governors Brad Henry and David Walters have weighed in, you know, on the pro side of opening up the primary process. It's clear. I mean, when you have a shrinking base, whether you're a Democrat Party, Republican Party, you have to look at what are some alternatives to keep the decline from just continuing, and trying to do something where you've got, and I think the number I saw in independents now in Oklahoma is it may be 22%. So, I mean, it's growing. And
certainly if you register more voters.
Yeah. Clearly, now the interesting part of the independent equation is that it's the younger voters that, as they register, are registering independent. Mm-hmm. They also are the ones, as we all know, that are the most difficult to get to the polls. But it does open up, particularly, I think, for Democrats in rural areas and places where they still can be very competitive. It opens up the opportunity to have a broader message, and maybe, as we know in primaries, where either party has to play to their, you know, to their base, and which is on the extreme side typically, it does open up an avenue to get a broader message out, which would be more appealing to more voters, and ultimately could begin to start to change the political landscape back in many of these areas, where Democrats still could be competitive if they could find and nominate the type of a person who would be able to be good in a general election, and not someone who is perceived as too extreme or has gotten out on many issues that still are not in sync with the majority of Oklahoma voters. So, you know, I think it's going to be an interesting transition, I think, that we're going to see over the next several election cycles. And ultimately, as things begin to level out, 10, 15 years down the road, Republicans may well see the need to entertain this idea as well. But I don't think anytime soon.
Well, I think that moderating influence works both ways, and I think that it would help the Republican Party, I think, to be a party that's not marginalized by its primary and primary runoff voters,
I think that's true on both sides.
I think
parties.
I think that moderating influence works out in both ways, and you know, to me, I think that that's a good deal. And if we can open the primaries and allow the independents to play that role where Democrats and Republicans are competing for a larger base during the primary elections.
But ultimately, on your point, though, about general elections, I think it is incumbent upon both parties to make sure that they go out and do sufficient candidate recruitment so that it isn't decided in a primary. I mean, that's not the role of one party or the other. That's the role of everyone to be out there trying to find competitive candidates who can, who can be on the ballot in a November general election. So, I think both parties have experienced that over the decades, so it's nothing unique. It's just something that they have to be very aware of, and they do have to ramp up the activity to be competitive.
Well, that gets us to the next conversation in electoral reform, and that is redistricting and making sure that we end up with more competitive seats. I think that one of the reasons that we see so many of these races decided in primaries right now is because you can have a great, well-funded, moderate candidate on either side. But if it's in a safe seat, the general election is really just for show. And we've seen some of those change over the last couple of years from Republican to Democrat or vice versa. Usually vice versa, Democrat to Republican. But
safe seats, even in southeastern Oklahoma, if you looked at the numbers still, you would say it's a Democrat safe seat, and yet Republicans have picked up some of those seats. Mm-hmm. It's many things beyond just redistricting, which seems to be, and frankly, as we all know, redistricting is all about the folks that are in office at the time. They're the ones that are going to not only decide those lines, but they're going to be the ones that are going to be interested in what's politically expedient and best for them, and that's that's, you know, that not always is good for the voter, but in general, it's a...
It's usually not. In general, though,
it's something that is very hard to, you know, it's very hard to change or deal with.
And we'll know next week from the Supreme Court whether or not independent redistricting panels that are separate and apart from the legislature, so you don't have legislators selecting their voters, rather it'll be the other way around, voters selecting the legislators. What a novel idea. We'll know whether or not that meets constitutional muster.
There you go. Now, just days after the horrific shootings in Charleston, South Carolina, residents in the northeast Oklahoma town of Pryor wake up to find racist pamphlets. The flyers from the local Ku Klux Klan chapter derided interracial marriages and called for a ban on businesses owned by minorities. Ryan, where does this land on the fine line between protected free speech and hate speech?
Well, hate speech can be protected speech. And you know, I think that our commitment to First Amendment principles is really easy to demonstrate whenever somebody's saying something that we can all agree with. Our right. ability to define where we're at in terms of really saying that we're believers in free speech is when we're defending the most heinous, reprehensible, awful, hateful speech out there. Where you cross the line is between speech and conduct, right? And that's the courts have drawn that line continually, and I encourage them to continue to do that. Nevertheless, what these pamphlets do is they remind us that racism is alive and well, and you know, we see these examples of overt racism with pamphlets like this, but we know that racism plays out in the daily lives of millions of Oklahomans every day, whether or not you have it directly in your face in a pamphlet or not. I mean, it's everything from arrest statistics to employment to housing, you name it. Racism is alive and well in 2015. And, these pamphlets are a stark reminder of it. But they're also a stark reminder that our ability to combat racism also rests upon our ability to exercise our right to free speech. And we can only protect that if we're willing to go to bat for some of the most awful, reprehensible stuff out there.
Neva.
Well, I agree. I mean, it's unfortunate, and it's unfortunate for this community. 3 days after the shooting that you mm-hmm. referred to, here these pamphlets are, on their doorsteps on Sunday morning when they come outside. And it's not new. They did it They did it 5 months ago on Martin Luther King Day, the very same type of tactic. And, Ryan's right. I mean, the sheriff said, look, no laws have been violated. It does heighten the awareness. I think it is unfortunate that the Ku Klux Klan of northeastern Oklahoma chose this community, which has less than 1% African Americans in their community by the census, to try to focus this kind of hate mongering and this kind of reprehensible activity. And it certainly, for the folks in that community, I mean, it's an unfortunate thing for them to have to experience, and I guess experience again and again would be what it appears the case is.
Well, the Klan's not known for their good judgment.
No, so. and try to attach this to Father's Day and
right.
try to do yeah. all of the hyped up rhetoric that they did associated with that is, again, I mean, Ryan's right. I mean, we have to acknowledge the right of free speech and to protect that. But it does give us pause and makes us want to be aware and be vigilant in talking about the fact that these groups still exist and frankly are growing across our country
right.
and we need to be aware of that so that we don't revisit many things in our past history that I think none of us that experienced it in those years want to see again.
Mm-hmm. And this is the season finale of This Week in Oklahoma Politics. We'll return in September with more insights, and Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.